All right, Alexander, let's talk about what is happening in Ukraine. What is the situation in what is the political situation with the Zelensky regime? There are no talks taking place, obviously, because of the conflict in Iran. So all of the negotiations have been put on hold. And what is the situation on the front line? Where do you want to begin? Which area should we start with?
I think, again, we need to start with Zelensky and his political position in Kiev. Today, as of the time that we're making this program, there is another reason for Zelensky to be increasingly nervous about the whole situation with Ukraine, about America's commitment to the war, because there are reports appearing all across the media that in the midst of rising oil prices and energy costs, because of the conflict with Iran and with Trump increasingly looking to Putin for help to try to get an off-ramp in the conflict in Ukraine, the United States is thinking of lifting oil sanctions on Russia. Now, if that happens, if the United States lifts oil sanctions on Russia, that has a number of immediate and practical consequences. It means that the Ukrainian attempt, Zelensky's attempt to cut off Russia's oil exports, to put a squeeze on the Russians, which, by the way, has never been particularly successful. Anyway, that ends. It means that attacks on Russian tankers, seizures by the United States of Russian tankers on the high seas. And it's important to stress that without the backing of the United States, without the US Navy and the US military and the US intelligence community being actively involved in that kind of operation, it is impossible. It is unviable. So, for Zelensky, that would be a complete disaster. It would be the end of the single most important policy that he's been trying to promote over the last year or so, the attack on Russia's energy system. It would mean that the Trump administration has reverted to the Biden policy of saying that the Russian oil industry, the Russian oil export industry is off limits. And that created some tensions between Biden and Zelensky. It would create even bigger tensions between Zelensky and Trump. And well, I mean, ultimately, that would be the end of Project Ukraine, in my opinion. And it would be a disaster for Europe, for the Europeans as well, because the Europeans have been cranking up towards doing this. If the Americans pull those sanctions, then they've also pulled the sanctions, the rug under the feet of the Europeans as well. So that must be causing ever greater alarm for Zelensky. Also, if, as is now starting to look like is the case, Trump is looking for help from Putin to try to bring the conflict in the Middle East to an end. That in itself is unsettling for Zelensky because it means that the Russians now have leverage over the United States, or perhaps more precisely over Donald Trump. Donald Trump has, over the last few weeks, as we discussed in our previous video talking about this conflict, Trump has made fairly clear what he thinks of Zelensky, calling him P.T. Barnum and all of that. It looks as if the United States is going to have to be more accommodating to Russia from now on. That may mean less active US support for the Ukrainian war effort. That is also a disaster for Zelensky and for Ukraine. And with all of that going on, one suspects that the divisions within the political system in Kiev are going to start to intensify. Zelensky is now involved in a very bitter row with Orban,
yeah,
and with Fico. Hungary and Slovakia are stopping supplies of diesel oil and electricity and that kind of thing to Ukraine. But most critically, they are blocking the loan. They're blocking movement, the placing, I think, of this loan, the 90 billion euro loan, in the financial markets, the paying of this loan to Ukraine. That is causing a financial crisis, a deficit crisis to start to develop in Ukraine itself. That is, for Zelensky personally, an existential issue. We discussed many, many times that Zelensky needs a constant flow of funds into Ukraine in order to keep the various stakeholders in the regime happy. If it looks as if that is going to be stopped, that is also a disaster for Zelensky and for the government that he holds. And of course, he's now getting statements from people like Budanov, which appear to be taking a different line on the Ukrainian conflict. So Zelensky has to worry about all of that. He's also probably got to worry about the Russians. And I'm talking now about the diplomacy, not about the war, because the Russians have been making a whole series of statements recently about where the negotiations have been going. Again, it's been Lavrov who's been saying the mostly. Putin continues to remain silent about the negotiations. But Lavrov has said that the Russians came to an agreement with Trump and the Americans in Anchorage. We've never known what this agreement amounted to. Nobody has ever provided us with the details, but it doesn't seem as if it was that different from Istanbul Plus, given all of the other things that the Russians have said. Lavrov has said that all the goodwill in Anchorage has gone, that there's no longer any spirit of Anchorage left, but the Russians are going to stick to the agreement that they made with Trump, and they're not going to move beyond it. That this is as much, as far as they are prepared to go. From this point on, it is for Ukraine and for the United States to make the big moves. And a Russian foreign ministry official, a man called Miroshnik, repeated that this morning, just before we made this program. Now, we don't know exactly what it was that Putin and Trump agreed in Anchorage. Zelensky presumably does. He has already made it clear many, many times that whatever it was that they agreed in Anchorage, that is unacceptable for him and for Ukraine. So from Zelensky's point of view, the Russians are standing firm. They are in a position of diplomatic advantage because of the mess the United States has got itself into over the Middle East. That must also be making Zelensky increasingly nervous, and it may lead to people within Kiev, people like Budanov, saying Ukraine cannot survive a further year of this war. They might be saying, look, the time has come for us to start doing what the Russians are telling us to do, to move towards their positions, to start moving towards Istanbul Plus ourselves, because that is the only way that we can save whatever remains to be saved. Now, as for the situation in the war, this is the time of the spring thaw. It is apparently starting. It is expected to be very prolonged this year because there was very, very heavy snowfalls in January and February. So all that snow has to melt. It's going to create very boggy conditions. That is going to slow movement across the front lines. But nonetheless, despite the fact that we are in the period of the thaw, we are continuing to get reports about further Russian advances. The Russians are getting closer and closer to Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. They seem to have seen off this Ukrainian offensive in Zaporozhye region, if it ever happened at all. And of course, they continue their missile and missile strikes and drone strikes across Ukraine. And with shortages of air defense missiles in the United States, and shortages also, by the way, of air-to-air missiles, Ukraine is not really in a position any longer to counter these drone and missile strikes. So there's going to be a major Russian offensive, probably starting in April. Ukraine's army is reduced in size. Russia's army is increasing in size. Sirsky, the Ukrainian commander, has just confirmed this, and U.S. support is now looking more wobbly than ever.
Lavrov, he meant in his statement that the minimum Russia will accept is what they agreed on with the U.S. in Alaska. Is that what he was saying?
Yes, yes.
That's going to be the starting off point of negotiations. Is that what you took from Lavrov's statement?
No, I took it differently. I said this is now our firm position. We are not prepared to move beyond Alaska. Whatever it was we agreed in Alaska, that is now the terms upon which this war ends.
Is that Istanbul Plus, though, or is that something? I mean, we don't know, but what do you think?
We don't know.
Is it less than Istanbul Plus? Is it more than Istanbul Plus?
I think it is
Istanbul Plus?
I think it is Istanbul Plus. This is what is so strange, because the Russians have never told us. Lavrov, in his final, in certain comments, he said, by the way, Lavrov admitted for the first time that there has been significant internal criticism in Russia of the entire negotiation process. He said that all sorts of people have been criticizing this negotiation. He said that the people who are making these criticisms do not know, however, what has been going on in the negotiations itself. So he seems to be suggesting that these people who have been so critical are misinformed, and that if they were better informed, they would be less critical of the negotiations than they have been, which strongly suggests that it is Istanbul Plus. I'm going to make a guess that this big concession that the Russians have been talking about, which they make out repeatedly to be this enormous concession, really wasn't a very big concession at all. It was mostly about sequencing. It was about, firstly, a Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass, and then there would be further discussions, and then there would be a withdrawal by the Ukrainians of Zaporozhye and Kherson region, that it would all be done in stages rather than all at once. I think that is probably the best way to understand whatever it was that Putin and Trump agreed with each other in Istanbul. In Alaska.
In Alaska. How do the Russians trust Trump going forward, given everything that has happened, including with definitely with Iran, with the assassination of Khamenei during negotiations, the war in Iran, everything that has happened? How do the Russians actually trust in Trump, especially with Lavrov saying that it's Alaska? What we agreed on with Trump is Alaska. That's what we're sticking with. But given everything that has happened since Alaska, which was 6 months ago,
Yeah, oh, absolutely. A lot has happened more than six months ago. 10 months ago, I think. Not 10 months, but anyway, it's a long time ago. And of course, there was a Valdai attack.
The Valdai attack, yeah.
And the assassination attempt on Alexeyev. Right. By the way, Korshakov, who is the head of Russian military intelligence and who is a negotiator, who's been a negotiator both in Abu Dhabi and in Geneva, and who was for a certain period, the lead negotiator and the two talks in Abu Dhabi. He's actually confirmed, by the way, what we said, that the Russians have indeed made a big thing of the Alexeyev assassination attempt in the negotiations. And he said that they spoke to the Ukrainians and the Americans about it in very tough terms. Take from that what you will. But how do the Russians trust Trump? Well, they don't. At least many people in Russia don't trust Trump. That was basically what Lavrov admitted, that much of the criticism of this whole negotiation process that is taking place in Russia is by people who are coming forward and saying, you can't trust Trump. He lies. He's a trickster. He's duplicitous. He's provided help to Ukraine to conduct the dirty war against us, even whilst he pretends to be negotiating with us. And Lavrov, by the way, Lavrov's words were very defensive. He said, you know, that people who make these criticisms are not familiar with the negotiations. It didn't really address the question of trust, or rather the lack of it. And Peskov, Putin's spokesman, came up with an incredibly lame answer. He said, well, you know, you mustn't look at what happened in the talks between the Americans and the Iranians and assume that it's the same in the talks between us and the Americans, because in the talks between the Iranians and the Americans, the Iranians and the Americans weren't meeting directly. They were working through an intermediary, whereas we are in the same room as the Americans and we can look into their eyes and we can judge their sincerity that way. Well, I mean, to say that's lame, to say that is, in fact, almost ridiculous. I mean, I'm saying it, but lots of other people in Russia are saying it too. So you can see that the Russians, most people in Russia do not trust Donald Trump anymore. Most people in the Russian elite do not trust Trump anymore. And Putin and his key officials are finding it very difficult to come up with rational reasons as to why they continue to trust Trump still. As it happens, I don't think they trust Trump. Until Putin and Trump spoke over the last few hours to discuss the situation with Iran, Putin had avoided speaking to Trump since December. I think that the Russians are prepared to interact with the Americans further at this time because they sense that the Americans have weakened themselves with the Iranian debacle and that the Russians, as a result, have leverage over them. But I don't believe there's any trust. I don't believe that there is any goodwill. And, of course, the Russians are coming back and they're saying, we went as far as we are prepared to go in Alaska. We are not prepared to go any further. That was what Lavrov said. That is what Miroshnik was saying just before this program was made.
Putin cutting off energy to the EU. Yeah. What do you make of that? I believe his statement was, by April 25th, the EU is going to take a decision on Russian energy, a negative decision, obviously, on Russian energy. They're going to completely cut off all Russian oil and gas. That's the decision that the EU is going to enforce. And Putin's statement was that we'll probably beat them to the punch. We'll probably redirect our energy, oil and gas to better customers and to other sources, to the recipients. What do you make of that statement? How does that affect the EU, given everything that we've seen play out in Iran? And what does that mean for Orban and Fico,
right,
who have this row with Zelensky going on? It revolves around the Druzhba oil pipeline. It also, at least in the case of Hungary, is now focused on an 80 million euro convoy of cash and gold making its way to Ukraine. What is that about?
Yeah, no, well,
where was this cash and gold? What is this cash and gold doing in Hungary? Why is it going to Ukraine? What's the purpose of this cash and gold? These are the questions that Hungary is asking Ukraine, and Ukraine is getting very sensitive about it. The Zelensky regime is very sensitive about this 80 million in cash and gold. I wonder why. So,
let's start with the convoy of gold. I mean, it's obviously needed to gild the toilets in Kiev. I mean, that's obviously what it's needed for. This is a vital necessity.
How many gold toilets do they need?
Exactly. But no, seriously, what that tells you, this convoy of gold and all that, it's clearly the money that some people are needing for when they escape. I mean, the thing is, you need gold. If you're going to escape from a particular country, if you need to go on the run, if you need to get out fast, obviously you can't take Ukrainian currency with you because that's going to lose value. You can't. You can use dollars or euros. But remember, that can be traced, that can be monitored, all of those things. So people on the run, one of the things they need, they use, is gold coins, or gold in whatever form. And the fact that we're looking at movements of gold, It means it's another further sign of a growing loss of confidence in Kiev itself and of the fact that people in Kiev need to have this gold because it's part of their escape routes, part of their flight plans, if I can put it like that. I've encountered this myself before. I've come across people who've done this. Just to say.
Yeah, that's why they're so sensitive.
That's why they're
so sensitive. The Zelensky regime.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, so Putin's statement about cutting off EU oil and gas.
Yes. Well, let's talk about this because that is very important. First of all, the thing you need to understand is that when Putin talks about this, he's not thinking aloud. He's communicating a decision which has already been made. There's obviously been discussions about this within the Russian Security Council, within the relevant oil ministries. All that needs to be done now is to actually sort this out with the actual producers, the gas and oil producers, the people in the Arctic who do the liquefied natural gas, the people in the oil industry, and to discuss with the ship owners, the rerouting of cargoes and all of that kind of thing. The ship owners, the oil executives, the pipeline executives, all of those people. So the decision has been made. It is, as of now, purely a technical issue. So the Russians are going to stop all energy exports to Europe. Now, Putin has said this over the course of two meetings. One was a brief encounter he had with Pavel Zarubin, who's a journalist, and that was where he first announced this intention. He then held a much bigger meeting in which he discussed this all over again. It was basically a discussion about energy policy. Over the course of that meeting, he was very careful to say that Russia is a totally reliable supplier of energy, and it will continue to supply energy to its reliable customers. And he again said that those reliable customers include Hungary and Slovakia. So Hungary and Slovakia are exempted from this policy. Quite how the gas and the oil is going to reach these countries, that is a different matter. But the Russians are not cutting Hungary and Slovakia off. They are cutting off the rest of the EU. Now, that is a disaster for the EU. Putin did not say that the Russians will reverse this policy if the sanctions are lifted. He said that he didn't talk about the sanctions at all, but he said, you know, clearly they're not reliable. We need to focus on Asia. That is where our reliable customers are. Now, think what's going to happen over the next few months. Gas storage levels in Europe are currently very low for this time of the year. And we don't know what's going to happen over the summer. If it's a hot summer, the storage levels might fall still further. Qatar is not going to be able to supply natural gas for several months, weeks or months, irrespective of whether the Straits of Hormuz are reopened soon or not. It takes time to get that whole complex, that gas export complex, fully operational again. That may take up to a year. If we're talking about LNG, the Asian customers who have deep pockets are going to be in competition with the Europeans for American LNG. Russia is the second biggest supplier of LNG to Europe, as I understand it, after the United States. This is going to deepen the energy shock in Europe. Come the autumn, we're already seeing gas prices rising in Europe. Come the autumn, as things stand, it's going to look very, very much worse unless Donald Trump and the Americans rush more LNG to Europe to plug the holes. And well, I have to say, with Donald Trump, counting on him doing that is a fool's idea.
Yeah. All right. We will agreed. We will end this video there at theduran.locals.com. We're on X, we're on Rumble, we are on Telegram, we are also on Substack. The link is in the description box down below. And go to the Duran Shop, pick up some merch. There is a link to the Duran Shop in the description box down below as well. Take care.